If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What's good, internet? Welcome to another edition of Waypoint Article Reads, right here on Waypoint Radio. Obviously, Rob normally hosts these, but Rob is the writer in question this time, which means that I'm going to throw to him. He's going to tell you all about a game called Frostpunk, which is the latest city builder by 11-Bit Studios, the team that made this war of mine a few years ago. It's a kind of a post-apocalyptic, snowbound city builder. It's really neat, and his article, his review was fantastic. So listen to that, and then stick around, as always, for a conversation between he and I about that. And just as a heads up, the feed is going to get pretty stuffed with content, with hashtag content, in the next couple of days, because we have this, we have a BattleTech review and read that'll go in either before or after this. I haven't figured that out yet. And I also have a special interview with John Everest, who is the composer for BattleTech. And it's like a 40-minute conversation between he and I about composition and giant robots. I did ask him what instrument an awesome assault class mech would be if it were an instrument, and he had an answer. So look for that in the feed also. But until then, and until we come back with a conversation, here is Rob to read The Industrial Apocalypse of Frostpunk is More Truth Than Fiction.
As long as the furnace was lit, there was hope. On its front page, the local paper started tracking how many days were left before the furnace at the massive LTV steel mill in northwest Indiana finally went cold and silent. It was a kind of civic vigil for the mill, and all the people that depended on it. LTV was history. The writing had been on that particular wall for over a year, but the plant still had value as long as fires burned in the heart of its titanic blast furnace. There was still time for someone to come along and keep the mill open, keep the paychecks coming, and hold the future at bay just a little longer. The day the fire went out, it was front page news. Beneath the headline, the Times ran a long telephoto lens shot of the caretaker crews leaving through the rusted chain link gates, the incomprehensibly convoluted, titanic shape of the rust-brown furnace complex standing silent and still behind them. It felt like a death. Which I suppose is why Frostpunk, the new post-apocalyptic city builder from 11-Bit Studios, the team behind this war of mine, reminds me so much of home. It's a survival-focused city builder in which the last remnants of industrial-age Britain huddle for warmth and safety around a single massive coal-fired generator in the far north, while the rest of the world perishes in a sudden and unrelenting ice age. As long as the city keeps the generator powered, their homes provide shelter, their kitchens provide food, and their hospitals provide care. If that generator falters, however, then everyone perishes amidst the ruins that used to be a community's civic infrastructure. Within the game, it's a metaphor for a lot of different things, but I come from a place where it was profoundly literal. The generator sits at the heart of Frostpunk's small, frigid maps and gives them their novel layouts and character. Everything is laid out in concentric rings around that generator. Buildings inside the generator's radius of effect are kept considerably warmer than the outdoor temperature, but those beyond it are at the mercy of the weather and their own insulation. You can see the effects most dramatically in the map's thermal overlay, where the generator and its surroundings burn merrily in reds and yellows, while buildings on the edge of the settlement appear in colder aquamarines and deep blues. But the effects are almost as dramatic in the normal view, thanks to 11-Bit Studios' gorgeous and detailed artwork. Snow melts to slush and mud in the streets around the generator, and homes and buildings glow with warm light from their windows. While in colder areas, you'll watch work crews struggle through dense snowdrifts, and buildings become encrusted in frost. It's a game that captures the subtle differences between harmless, heavy snow and a terrifying, lethal blizzard, and makes its struggle for warmth and survival feel almost palpable as you play it. The goal in Frostpunk is to survive each of its scenarios for a fixed number of in-game days. The main campaign scenario ends after 60, and as the days go on, the weather keeps getting colder. At the start, most of the map is only chilly, and the generator keeps buildings near it comfortable. But as the temperature plunges deeper below freezing, you'll need to run the generator hotter to keep the temperatures up to livable levels for your citizens, which means you need three other things: new technology upgrades, raw materials, and healthy workforce. And here is where Frostpunk begins to get brutal. You only have so many people to start with, and it's not long before you have more jobs than you do sets of hands to do them. As the weather worsens, your citizens are increasingly likely to get sick and even die, which means gaps start opening in your workforce. But your need for ever greater resources to meet the rising energy demands of the cold weather means that you need your people to get more productive as the game goes on. Adding to the pressure, you can adopt brute force solutions like 14-hour workdays or 24-hour emergency shifts, but those both take a toll on health and morale within the city. Inevitably, you start facing choices between working people too hard, or underpowering the generator, or to start running your city at a coal deficit that will eventually cause that generator to shut down. If you don't balance these bad options effectively, you'll enter death spirals of cold, illness, declining production, and facility shutdowns. If I have a criticism of Frostpunk as a strategy game, it's that each of these scenarios tend to unfold in very predictable fashions, which makes it far easier to avoid these traps after your inaugural playthrough. If you've seen an event once, you've seen how it will play out in every subsequent game. Once you've seen the endgame of each of the game's three scenarios, you pretty much know the exact bar you'll have to clear in order to win. That hasn't stopped me from trying to do better as I navigate these crises, but it has meant that the game feels much less suspenseful and much more manageable than I think suits its end times tone. But if you don't stay ahead of your problems, or if your solutions end up causing new problems, it's just a matter of time before your people banish you from the city for your mismanagement. Because as you institute austerity measures or wring more labor from your workers, discontent rises. And as things go wrong and people start dying from exposure or passing out from overwork, their hope declines. Let the discontent bar get too full, or let the hope bar get too empty, and you'll quickly find yourself with just 48 hours to turn things around before it's game over and your people banish you from the city to die in the snow. As your little avatar struggles through the blizzard, you'll see the townsfolk express grudging satisfaction that you're gone, and now they can start putting things right without you. There are two systems that exist on top of the city manager that help you escape these traps and pressures, one that expresses Frostpunk's fiction, and one that expresses its politics. On the fictional side, you can send scouting teams out into the world to search areas of interest where you'll often be rewarded with some extra resources and a snippet of text that sheds light on both the disaster that's befallen the world and how that world differs from our own. It's generally very well done and supported by some terrific artwork, but it's also where Frostpunk reveals a deeply generic steampunk backstory. As an aesthetic, steampunk is often defined by a collection of affectations and stylistic tics that are bound up in nostalgia for Victorian and Edwardian Britain. We get a taste of that in the intro to Frostpunk. Zeppelins circle the London skyline, giant steam locomotives churn forward across endless snowfields. More of it pops up in the game itself. Giant automatons lumber between factories and the generator, capable of replacing entire work crews with ceaseless, weatherproof productivity. Your scouts uncover relics of the lost British Empire, beached dreadnoughts abandoned in the ice pack, scientific outposts with grim notes and warnings from the Royal Explorers who saw this disaster coming. When you come across what's left of some American expeditions, Frostpunk completes its steampunk bingo card with some references to Nikola Tesla. But I don't think Frostpunk falls into the trap of being an ode to the British Empire and its exploitative social order. After all, most of the government's plans clearly ended in disaster, and at least two of Frostpunk's campaigns heavily imply that the ruling class intended their generator as a salvation for themselves and not for any of the workers they meant to abandon to the cold. Rather, I think what Frostpunk is nostalgic for is industry and labor in an age of mechanical and analog technology, a time when you could touch and observe the workings of the devices that made the world run, and they still left a place for you to contribute with the strength and skill of your own hands, a time when the factory meant life, security, and a future for everyone. The second of Frostpunk's metal layers is where it paints its picture of the politics within this ad hoc company town. Every 24 hours, you get to pass a new law that starts to change the character of your little community, as well as how people feel about living there. For instance, if you're desperate for additional labor early in the game, You can repeal child labor restrictions and put kids to work in safe workplaces, which will give you some extra hands to expand resource production at the cost of upsetting everybody. On the other hand, you can choose the child shelters option that lets you build insulated daycares, which will give your citizens greater hope for the future. Those choices all happen on the adaptation policy tree. But in the main campaign, you also choose between two other law tracks, order or faith. As their names imply, both offer different ways of handling both the discontent and creating hope for the future. Order presupposes that what your community really wants and needs are cops and staff meetings, while faith means churches. If that dichotomy makes your skin start to crawl, well, I think it's meant to. Each tree provides some very useful bonuses at the start. For instance, the order track starts out with morning meetings of the full workforce, where the shift supervisors will outline the day's plan and how things stand with the city as a whole. It gives people reassurance that their efforts aren't being wasted, and they go to work happier. Likewise, you start out building local neighborhood watches that protect homes and depots from theft, and people feel a bit safer and happier, knowing that their neighbors are working together to safeguard rations and coal stores. But as you proceed down that track, things get questionable and then outright fascist. You can unlock the option to build a prison, which isn't an inherently bad idea. My prison was empty for most of the game. But the prison has an ability that lets you round up malcontents and toss them in lockup for a cooling off period. But why stop there? As long as they are in prison, you can unlock a law that lets you perform some re-education on them. For that matter, you can establish a propaganda center that will provide a bonus to hope, but at the cost of raising overall discontent. Before you know it, your mouse is hovering over the loyalty oaths law, and your settlement has basically turned into a labor camp. However, you don't have to pass these laws, and the end of the game seems to suggest maybe you shouldn't. The game's tagline is, "The city must survive," but in the end the crisis may pass, at which point you and your people will be left with the ramifications of how you survived. You can either fuel the generator or make human sacrifices to it, and perhaps the best thing I can say about Frostpunk is that it seems to know the difference. Not everyone does. When the blast furnace of the LTV mill slowly shut down in the early 2000s, it felt like people in the region would have sacrificed just about anything to bring it back to life. But what was too quickly forgotten was that those jobs weren't really anybody's dream back in the post-war decades when that work was hard but plentiful. For all the talk about bringing those jobs back to the region, it wasn't really the jobs people missed. It was the safety net they provided. The place you could go to start building toward whatever future you wanted. A decent retirement and a pension. Or a move into gray-collar management or the trades. Or maybe, like it was for my father, a place where you could have enough money to raise a family and go to school so that you wouldn't have to spend all your nights feeding the coke ovens, only to head home in the early hours covered in a film of oily soot that never quite washed off. But it was the blast furnace that our newspaper's camera lingered on, gazing past the out-of-focus workers in the foreground, as if just by keeping the furnace lit we could have preserved the comfort and security we'd so long taken for granted. It's hard to capture in a headline, and impossible to capture in a single photo, that the jobs that the furnace supplied required decades of work and effort to transform into livelihoods. The furnace was just a source of heat and power for steelmaking. Workers are the ones who turned it into the heart of a community.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
So, Rob, one of the things I didn't expect when I first got the draft for this review was it to open up and close on this recollection of your home and a nearby mill, a nearby industrial plant. What type of plant was it again?
It was a steel mill.
It was just a straight up steel mill. I knew you were from Indiana, and I knew that you had some history with like labor, you know, like with like labor ass labor. But I didn't expect to see that in this Frostpunk review, but then, you know, it fits really cleanly into your perspective here, since the game is actually, it sounds so focused on that angle. Can you talk a little bit about what your history is there and kind of how that led you to some of the things that you've written about here?
Oh yeah. I mean, like, pretty much everyone on both sides of my family went through one of the major manufacturing facilities near where I grew up. So I grew up in Northwest Indiana, which is really different from the rest of Indiana. It's kind of the sort of industrial sprawl of Chicago.
Gotcha.
in a lot of ways. And so Chicago just kind of trails off into like lakeshore wharves. And then when it becomes Indiana, it's like all steel mills and a massive refinery and stuff like that. And, you know, in its heyday, steel was really the economic heart of the region. And, like, pretty much everybody on my mom's side of the family, my father, sort of through their good offices, I guess, they all ended up working at the mills. And sort of the way it worked for a lot of mills, a lot of families who depended on them, was that you sort of had like almost a company loyalty to a particular mill. So like if you were an Inland Steel family, your family members pretty much all ended up working for Inland Steel. Huh. But like if you were LTV, and I don't think it was called LTV back when my dad and my uncles worked there. I think it might have been a different company. But sort of it was generations would sort of serve on the same production line and sort of move through that blue-collar ladder. As it were. And, you know, growing up, like hearing about when my mom grew up, I'd always sort of imagine them as a really impoverished family because so many of the stories about when she was very young focus on some really hard times. And I mean, you know, she was one of 11 kids. So obviously, like, finances were stretched to the breaking for that family. But it wasn't until years later that I realized that one of the reasons things were so tough early on is that my grandfather got caught up in the 1959 steel strike, which is one of the longest labor actions in U.S. history. It was 4 months nationwide. And for 4 months, basically, every steel mill in the U.S. shut down.
Right.
And it's still a controversial strike. It's still like, were the tactics correct? Were the policies pursued correct? Did it sort of set a bomb at the heart of the U.S. steel industry?
Right.
You know, was that the beginning of the end? It's tough to say, but what was undeniable is that when I was growing up, the mills weren't hiring as many people as they used to, right? Like, there was kind of this sense that old-timers worked at the mills, but there wasn't a lot of – that's not where, if you were growing up, your aspirations lay. And so it's weird because of the aesthetic of Frostpunk, which has this really great industrial look to it. In a weird way, because I think the buildings aren't like super recognizable and not super distinctive, the way your entire settlement in Frostpunk kind of looks like this ramshackle construction of like corrugated steel.
Yeah, that whole place feels like it's been stapled together, you know?
Yeah. And that's kind of how mills look. That's kind of how, like, and that's, you know, industry is engineering without architecture in a lot of ways. And I think Frostpunk has that look. And it reminded me so vividly of this thing I'd almost forgotten, which was this LTV blast furnace shutdown. And I remember talking to a friend of mine, you know, because you'd ask after each other's extended family. Like, I was in a pretty comfortable, you know, posh burb. This is where, you know, the prosperous kids of mill workers ended up in my suburb. But everyone still had family there. And, you know, I talked to a friend, you know, and we're all asking after each other's families, like, well, how are your uncles going to be? How's your dad going to be? And because it wasn't, you know, everyone was far enough along that, like, retirement was almost within sight, but it wasn't here yet, man.
And it sounds like you didn't have that thing that some communities have, which is you do the work to get out and then you never look back. And you don't even talk about the mill. You don't even talk about the locomotive factory. You don't ever talk about the coal mines again. Right? Like, you get out and then you're gone and that is it. It sounds like there was still a degree to which the mills worked to anchor that community or at least keep ties in place.
You know, it's such a strange thing, right? Because, so East Chicago is where my parents lived and in a lot of cases, East Chicago is a lot like East Baltimore, mm-hmm. right? Like it's yeah. it's one of those communities that was heavily dependent on manufacturing. Yep. And for a long time, there was nothing to escape. Like if you had a good union job, right. you didn't really – like you hoped that your kids didn't have to work as hard. But there wasn't the sense of like, oh, shit, this place is a trap.
Right.
But somewhere between like the 70s and certainly by the 90s, East Chicago, like Gary, Indiana – gets this reputation as this sort of, you know, blighted hellhole that you have to escape. And so it's this weird thing of like those jobs were still regarded as good. Mm-hmm. But I think for a lot of people, my dad's generation, my uncle's generation, they could serve as a stepping stone.
Right.
And certainly by the time I was a kid, you were – if somebody were able to get a job at the mill – they were very lucky to have that kind of like laboring job because mm-hmm. There weren't many left like it. But if you didn't, what else was there in the region? Right. Not a whole lot.
Right. Is that – so I mean the irony here, the difference or maybe – so I – on my mom's side, so my dad's side is from North Jersey, which is like, you know, on the precipice of New York. And so on my dad's side, my family has always been very like – not worldly necessarily, right? You know, black church-going folks, like, you know, there is a local community feel. But there's always been, from everyone there, the notion that the world is bigger, right? Partially, I think mm-hmm. it's because I have uncles who served in the military and who've been all around the world. And so I grew up getting letters from my uncle in Germany, my uncle going overseas to fight in the first Gulf War. You're near New York, and so there's talent that passes through. You go to the concerts. You know that so-and-so is in town this weekend. And so my dad's side of the family, despite, again, like, you know, I've been to the block that my dad grew up on dozens and dozens and dozens of times, and he can point to every house and say, you know, obviously, like, my aunt still lives there. I know where my grandmother's house was. I know all I can describe to you in detail the splintered wooden staircase that it wraps up and around this three-story home that my dad grew up in, at the top two floors, basically. And I can tell you where, like, the baseball fields are nearby. You yep. cut back through the woods, and I can point at things that are like dark, that are like, oh, this is where this bad thing happened, because I've heard the story so many times. But there was always from them a sense of like wonder and not even escape, but like the world is a big place and we can go wherever we want, right? Or we can't go wherever we want unless we work hard, and then we can go wherever you want. And for me, my dad has always had that vibe, right? Like my dad went to play basketball in England, and he's always been like the person who's like, we should figure out how to go to the Olympics. We should figure out how to go to Disney. Like, we should figure out how to go on a real vacation. But on my mom's side is from a place called Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, which mm-hmm. is the sister city to Scranton, which you may have seen in The Office. So imagine that, like, completely nondescript, tiny American city, except a little bit smaller and a lot more working class, a lot more built around the coal mines, which dried up. And in Wilkes-Barre, there is this, sorry, Wilkes-Barre, as people from Wilkes-Barre call it, as I should call it as someone who was born there, there is the notion of the valley. You cannot get out of the valley. The valley will drag you back.
Do they just call it the valley?
It's the valley. You're from the Lehigh Valley. You're from the valley. Right?
Where I'm from, it's the region. It's the right. Calumet region for the Calumet River, but right. everyone. And this,
it's the region,
this spooks
right.
my girlfriend. She's like, I've never been to a place where everyone just calls something the region. What the hell does that mean?
Right.
And it's like, it means everything.
It means everything. It means everything. And the thing about the valley as a symbol of that is that, like, you know, the valley is M-shaped. You know, you got to climb the peak to get out. But then once you do, you can slide all the way back down. Either way, you can get to the top, and if you need to commit, which side do you want to fall down on? Do you want to fall back into the valley, or do you want to get the fuck out? And the reason I bring that up is because when I look at Frostpunk does not feel like this the small city near a metropolitan escape route. It feels like the valley, because you're in the snow, and all you have is the generator. And sure, maybe you send some people out every now and then, but you're never going to find the way to a paradise. What you have is what you're stuck with. You're in the snow. The generator is providing heat for you, and you better make the best of this, because by and large, no one gets out. And I think that's different for as a city builder, because a lot of city builders are then about, Oh, and you know, I think about the Anno series, right? Which is like, obviously they're based on a city. You're at a city, but like there's the gesture towards a wider world. There's trade with other networks. There's relationships with other groups. There's the idea of like, oh, we're going to build this and then we're going to move and build this. But from what you've written about Frostpunk, it's the generator and then ice for miles.
Yeah, and I think that's why it – that's the other reason why this resonated so hard was this feeling that I think for a lot of people in either industrial regions or places that were sort of on the supply chain for industrial regions, right? So like auto, steel, and coal was this like artery of jobs and economic security that like pumped blood through – you know, the central U.S. for decades. And as those things started to sicken and wither, entire communities went with them. But the funny thing is, like, that happens so slowly.
Right.
That by the end, you're just clinging to the last industries and factories and whatever that are still standing.
Right.
And hoping that they can just hold out. And I think that the metaphor of Frostpunk, that there's this idea of this storm coming. Like, if you do not keep this thing powered and lit, you're all going down. I feel like, you know, to a degree, that's how it feels to see these industries wither within a region. This sense that, like, well, what comes after? And the answer is, like, you know, in reality, the answer is a lot of less good jobs, a lot of scrimping and saving and hardship, and some people go under entirely. But at the time, you can't even see that much of a future. It's just literally like, if that thing goes, this entire community is hosed. Everything that, you know, depends on it is gone. And I think Frostpunk has that same feel of, well, we exist to service this massive, this massive industrial MacGuffin, right? And our entire community is both dependent on it, but also oriented toward serving it, right? Like it's this weird symbiotic relationship where like the machine changes the people who depend on it, and the people power the machine and adapt it to their ends,
right? One of the things here that is interesting is you talk about the storm coming, or one of the things that I was thinking about while editing this and while talking to you about it is, you know, at the heart of this game, there is this – I mean, at the heart of the game is the generator, but then around it, society blossoms, and throughout the game, you have these choices to make. Do you use child labor or not? Do you support – do you build churches, or do you lean into a kind of more of a police state? And in real life – politicians and policymakers and demagogues and ideologues all build storms rhetorically to argue for the necessity of policies like those. We need the children to be able to work. We need to get rid of a minimum wage, right? That's a real one. We need to get rid of a minimum wage.
I've got an even better one right now for you.
Please.
So in Wisconsin, they're building this massive Foxconn plant. Foxconn, yes. Notorious for their role as an Apple supplier, and they had the infamous suicide nets installed in their manufacturers because conditions were so bad and unrelenting, and people's existence was so precarious that they had a real problem where, like, there were routine on-the-job deaths by suicide in their plants. Wisconsin, like, courted Foxconn hard to build a massive facility in Wisconsin. And it's this bizarre idea of, like, for the money the state is giving away to get this deal done, they could have just given people a fuckload of money.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Like, it's written the check. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, could have done income assistance for the entire community that's going to come to depend on this thing.
Right.
But the thing is, it's literally a case of they're sacrificing a community to get this plant built. Like right now, there are places in the outskirts of Racine, Wisconsin, where they're trying to eminent domain away people's homes to make room for this factory. And of course, the jobs, now that we're starting to get an idea of what the actual jobs are going to be, guess what? They're all temp employees.
Of course.
They're all done through a contract.
These aren't jobs that will provide for a family for a long time and let you put your kids through school and make sure that, you know, both partners in a relationship or any partners in a relationship don't need to all have jobs. Like, it is temp work that you can't count on from season to season and from year to year. In those cases, whether that is courting a big company and giving them tax cuts and failing to provide for your citizens, or it's, again, you know, trying to get rid of minimum wage, trying to change safety regulations, getting rid of health regulations, getting rid of environmental regulations, what these kind of policymakers and lobbyists do is create this fictional storm, and they say, oh, this is the only way we'll survive the winter, so to speak, the only way that we can make the economy recover, the only way that we can keep jobs around, the only way. And we know that it isn't the only way, because there have been lots of only ways that have failed, and it turned out there was another way. I'm curious if in Frostpunk, a game in which the storm is real, a game in which the cold will kill you, not will make things harder or will force you to adjust, you know, and find a new white space in the marketplace, in which the storm will kill you, in which the storm is real, in which the cold is real, how does it maintain a sense of morality and possibility instead of falling into a sort of like the ends justify the means, and given the situation, we need to go all the way to that? Because as you write, it makes it feel as if, despite the fact that the conditions are harsh, it never says, and therefore authoritarianism and fascism and police statism are all justified.
Yeah, it's an interesting – so I was actually much more concerned about it until I beat it.
Okay.
Because it's when you beat it that it kind of judges what you've done. Like, it kind of then sort of looks back at the choices you made. So it's an interesting move there at the end where Frostpunk kind of says, okay, you survived. But at what cost? What choices did you make along the way? And I was lucky because there were certain things that I just couldn't bring myself to do. Like, I flirted with totalitarianism. Like, I had cops. Like, I had plenty of cops. I had a prison.
Right.
I once cracked down on protesters because they were about to go back to London. And they were going to take about, like, 50 people with them.
Right.
And they were all going to die. And so I was like, oh, this is a case. You know what? No, you're not going back to London. You're going to sit this one out in jail if necessary. But no, you're not going out and going back to London. We're at the North Pole, for Christ's sake. So I definitely like made some moves that even now I'm like kind of iffy about.
Sure.
But at the same time, like, what I couldn't bring myself to do was like institute the loyalty oath pledge. Which would have been, everyone is just loyal to the captain, and you all work for him now.
Right.
And the other thing is, increasingly, these problems – so the thing is, what those things are doing are not actually solving the problems your community faces. They're solving problems that you face.
And that's a kind huge distinction.
Yeah. Adaptation, that tree, is all very functional. Like, there's still some moral gray areas in there. Like, kids are going to get put to work at one way or another. It can either be in manual labor, or the more humane option is the older ones start helping out in hospitals and,
sure.
You know, and that kind of thing. So, yeah, they're going to get put to work somehow. But in general, everything is about, okay, how can we actually increase our productivity a little bit? How can we cut consumption during, you know, the cold snaps? How do we maintain, you know, basic – like, are we going to hold on to burial rites, or are we just going to dispose of the dead in the most efficient way possible? It's those kind of choices, and those are going to affect how you can adapt to resource shortages and the weather.
Right.
But on those – purpose tracks, order or faith, by the end, you're not actually addressing those resource issues. What you're addressing is the fact that people are fucking miserable.
Right.
And if they're miserable, they're going to depose you. And what those options allow you to do at the extremes is just basically shut down the ability for them to push back on you. You know, fuck
right.
you because I said so.
Right.
And that's not going to make people any safer. It's not going to keep anyone from dying, it's just going to let you pay those costs without caring a little longer.
Right. And those costs in the game mechanically are discontent and hope, right? There's a discontent bar that you do not want to fill up and a hope bar that you do not want to go down. The review doesn't get too tight into this, but from my experience with it, discontent rises as things go bad, basically, as you demand more from people. And hope is a thing that you can manage by agreeing to do things and then following through. Is that accurate?
For the most part, there's also some laws that, like, again, like, if you do ceremonial burials, for instance, right. People have hope because, like, look, right. we're not just throwing corpses in a pile, like, right. That kind of thing.
But so to talk to the other half of that, the thing about, like, oh, I promise I'll do blank. That's something that doesn't really show up here, and I haven't played this game since E3, so maybe this is just gone now. But one of the things that I was interested in was, or one of the things that seemed neat was, I could make a promise that would temporarily boost hope, but then I'd have to do it. Then I'd have to, like, commit to the thing and yep. actually succeed. Did that pop up for you as you played? And, like, can you tell me a story of that? Because I've been deep in BattleTech, as you know, and some other games, Swords of Ditto, other things, and so I've not had time to dig into this, and I'm curious how that actually functions in play.
Okay, so let me tell you about how I wiped out a city within, like, the first 36 hours. Okay, so here's an example of good intentions and promises gone awry. Basically, there are several tiers of housing that you get. And the first tier is basically
just
tents. Hey, Rob,
can you do that one more time? I lost you there, so I didn't hear anything you just said. I laughed so hard my internet shut off, I guess. All right, go ahead. Give me that one more time.
So basically, here's how I wiped out a settlement in the first 36 hours. And it's a story of, like, good intentions and promises gone awry. And sort of the driving force is that there's several tiers of housing in Frostpunk. Yeah. And the first tier is just tents, and they're super shitty, and when the weather gets cold, they don't actually, like, keep people very warm at all. It's, like, very minimal shelter. So I was just kind of looking at them as, like, oh, these are really just kind of resource sinks. Like, these suck. These aren't homes. These are, you know, bits of pipe with sheets hung off them. Like, I'm not even gonna waste the manpower or the resources to build these tents. No. People don't know it now, but in a few days' time, I'm going to build them nice bunkhouses with insulation and wood, and it's going to be great. And all you got to do is just sleep rough next to this generator. Hey, it's pretty toasty. The weather's mild so far, so, like, you know, it's not so bad. It's like you're camping. So
they'll put it on your gravestone. It's like you're camping. Rob Zachney, 2018.
Yeah. So, in the meantime, the thing you have to remember is, in the background of Frostpunk, there's always a bunch of other shit going on. Like, there's always, mm-hmm. like, yes, the housing problem is sort of slowly becoming an issue, but you also still need to keep shoveling, like, coal into that generator. Oh, there's a cold snap coming, which is going to mean cranking up the generator to generate more heat. And so I'm just trying to explain why maybe things didn't go the way I planned. Mm-hmm. So everyone's sleeping outside, and after about a day of this, someone's like, you know, homes would be nice.
Sure would.
And I was like, fuck you. You're going to get great homes soon, but just be patient. So I'm not dealing with this right now. Like, no homes. And then, like, everyone's, like, kind of unhappy and, like, okay, very unhappy. And they're working very hard, and people are starting to get sick, and I'm still like, you know what? I'll build a sick bay, but no homes. And then, so about, like, 2.5 days in, people are like, yo, you really need, like, we demand homes. Like, at this point, like, if you do not give us homes, there's going to be some major
hell to pay. Yeah, yeah. I want a home.
And you always have, a few different options. Your options really are kind of, yeah, we have homes at home, we or single black coffee, or bunkhouses. Uh-huh. So those are your options, and I went with the, all right, fuck it, like McDonald's.
Let's do it. All sorts of homes.
First, I need to research that tech.
Oh. Uh-oh. And I was like, done because it wasn't a priority for you.
Right. And it's one tier up on the tech tree. So you actually have to unlock that tier by paying an additional resource cost. And now there's a lot of people sick. So a lot of workplaces like are fully staffed, but the people aren't actually there. They're like coughing up a lung in the medical tent.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, okay, it's going to take a little longer to get that tech unlocked. Cool. It's going to be fine. You know what? I will just make the research labs work 24/7 to unlock this tech, and I'll get the resource collection teams also working 24/7. It'll be great. It's not great at all. People are furious. Like, people hate working extended shifts. They really hate working 24-hour shifts. And so I am, like, trying to get this shit done. And the deadline is coming up fast, and I finally unlock bunkhouses, and I'm like, all right, great. How many do I need? Eight? I need eight bunkhouses? That's a lot. That's a lot of homes.
How many people was this?
I think I had like 80. I think it's like 10 per bunkhouse.
10 per bunkhouse, that sounds right, Rob. Come on.
Yeah. I mean, it's high capacity. Look, they have an enviable zoning situation in Frostpunk. Like, nobody's like, you have to build a detached home here. You just load up on triple deckers.
Just go for it.
Yeah. So I'm like, okay, how many can I build right now? Two.
Oh.
I can build two.
Oh, that's not what you promised, though.
No. So I am crash. Like, at this point, everyone is just like, just gather wood. Just gather wood as quickly as possible. That medical tent has wood in it. Tear it the fuck down.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. And so I get, like, everyone stops working. I'm like, tools down. We now have the wood. Everyone start building these homes. Don't you want your homes? You want to be happy, people. I'm trying to give you what you wanted. And, dude, I lost the race by, like, a pixel. Like, because you have the bars that fill up. My people, like, I broke my promise about 3 seconds before the final bunkhouse was completed.
No. All right. That's kind of bullshit. They should be able to, yeah, he's seven out of eight ain't bad. He's doing his best. The eighth one's right there.
Yeah, you know, but at the same time,
I take it back. That's how it is sometimes. Sometimes what it is like, there are so, you know, hope should have been higher anyway. Right? Like, you should have had hope higher for other things. This was the straw that broke the camel's back. You made a promise. You broke the promise.
Exactly.
And that is how people work sometimes. The rational thing sometimes escapes, or there's a larger sense of rationality, which is like, if you can't keep this super basic promise after all the other promises you didn't make or broke, it's time to go. You're out. And now I'm the captain or whatever. Is that what the fail state is, basically?
Yeah, you're deposed, and people don't execute you. It's weird. Like, Frostpunk has this really cool and dramatic trailer where somebody gets, like, basically murdered by Frost. That's not how the game ends. Basically, everyone's like, look, we understand you did your best, but you need to get the fuck out. Like, you're done.
Right.
And
can you still go, like, gather wood? Not, like, actually mechanically, but narratively in your mind when you're deposed, do you get to hang around the community and be the person who's,
oh,
like...
Oh, no, it's totally the, I am going outside and I may be sometime. It's right. That kind of like,
okay.
You are walking out into the snow to die of exposure because that is
so they are executing
the
you.
Do.
Okay, yeah. but it's like the Socrates version of it, which is like, all right, fuck it, I guess. Like, I could do this thing to stay. I could say, well, I'll stay around, but I'm not going to do that.
Right.
Got you. Well, Rob, I'm really excited to play Frostpunk. Like I said, Battletech has pretty much devoured my free time lately, but I've been so excited for Frostpunk over the last year that I'm going to try to put some time away this weekend to dig in. Thank you so much for the review. It's a great review. You can go read it on the site, waypoint.vice.com. Please go read that. And there's a video review up also that is fantastic. Shout-outs to Danielle for cutting that and for Rob for providing the voiceover. And it's great. Go find that at youtube.com/waypointvice. Rob, where can people find you on the internet?
At Rob Zachney.
Rad, you can find me at Austin_Walker. You can follow all everything Waypoint does, twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypointvice. Again, youtube.com/waypointvice, twitch.tv/waypoint, and waypointadvice.com. As always, thank you to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. And then I just wanted to remind everybody again, heads up, the feed is going to be filled with stuff. We have this. We're going to have a Battletech review chat, and that's going to be a bigger review chat probably because I've played 20 some hours of that game, and Rob
I booked the rest of my afternoon.
Hell yeah,
cleared the schedule.
It is 2 p.m. Get ready for the 4 hour. It's probably not gonna be 4 hours long, but it'll probably be over an hour. It'll probably be a full size cast. Maybe that's just our Friday cast this week, Rob. I don't know. That might be the play. We'll talk about it. We'll figure it out. I have some questions to go over. I asked people on Twitter for questions. So look forward to that. And then again, I had a great conversation with John Everest, who is the composer for BattleTech. And that'll go up in the feed too, and then you can go also watch a little behind the scenes vignette of John making music for BattleTech with orchestras and an instrument that he invented. It's a whole thing. It's really a cool little video. So check that out. Is there anything else? Rob, can you believe we got this week in video games?
Like, dude, it's been a grueling week for the content production side, but yep. Like, it's joyous labor. In a lot of ways.
Yeah. The generator, it is warm. That's going to do it for us. We'll be back again. Have a good one, everybody. Peace.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.